Thanks so much for being with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, did you have a chance to view this year's spectacular fall colors? Maybe you had a nice drive through some of our state's scenic areas. The weather guys are here to tell you that the weather has a big impact on what kinds of colors we see in the fall. Larry Mueller here. Once again, Steve Ackerman back with us. He is Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. We already welcomed him, so I'm going to welcome John Martin. John, a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. John, good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
So today we'll talk about weather and a bit about fall colors, the busy hurricane season, and why naming the big storms is important. We'll also talk about why fall temperatures can be all over the place and northern Wisconsin's early snowfall. And, of course, we'll take your weather-related comments and questions and your photos, too. We'd love to see those as well. Send us photos to ideas@wpr.org. Your weather photos, or you can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Well, this year's been kind of a good year for fall colors in the trees. At least I've had a chance to observe them myself, and certainly on Facebook, I think about a third of my Facebook friends have sent beautiful photos. And the weather has an influence on the color, does it not? And I'm not sure.
Steve knows more about how the leaves change their color. I'd say from maybe we'll do this backwards from the perspective of the other kinds of weather that leads to a nice fall. We haven't really had a windy fall. I mean, we haven't had many frontal passages. We haven't had many well-organized cyclones that have come by, and that just leaves the trees, affixed with their leaves as they change color. So that's also a contributing factor. But Steve knows more about the physiology of the trees and how they respond to the overnight low temperatures and so on.
Steve, go ahead.
John's right. I mean, weather, the wind, the rain and things will take down the leaves before, we can get a lot of good color out of them. So it's been good for that. Greens, I think, as we learn with photosynthesis, the leaves are green because of chlorophyll. What the chlorophyll does is it reflects green light more than the other colors, and then it absorbs those colors to produce energy for the plant via photosynthesis. In the autumn, as they get ready for wintertime to start to come, the leaves, the trees pull back the chlorophyll out of the leaves. Leaves other chemicals behind, things I think it's called xanthophyll, as well as anthocyanin, I think that's how you say it. And those reflect different other colors, the yellows and the reds. And so the weather you want for, really bright colors, so that the chlorophyll comes out and those other colors stick, is you want cool weather at night, cool temperatures at night, so like in the low 40s, not freezing. And then in the summer, not in the summer, during the day, you want the sunlight out and bright sunny days. And those types of weather during the time when the trees are starting to go dormant, it is what will give you the brightest colors. And then, of course, the other thing is, the health of the trees. So what was the summer like? Were they, dealing with droughts? So that's going to stress the tree, and stressed trees aren't going to produce as brilliant a color either because they're just not quite as healthy.
Jim in Wanakee has a question that doesn't relate to fall color, but that's okay. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask the guest about the pandemic and the effects of people driving less, flying less, et cetera. There's less, you would think there's less carbon dioxide in the air and thus affecting the weather, in terms of climate change. And I'm just wondering if there's been any studies on that, or is there any ongoing studies? And, well, actually, I could tie it in with fall change. This is a long shot, but, you know, if this kept up, would that have any effect on, you know, the way or the time that the leaves change colors?
Hmm. Steve, what do you think?
Well, that's two good questions there. I'm going to go after the first one. The second one, I think, is also related to how we're influencing the climate, and that's leading to temperature moisture changes, which do affect plant life. With regard to changes in air quality because of the pandemic, there have been clear observations, some coming from satellites, which now measure some pollutant gases, not just carbon dioxide, but not nitrous oxide, things that come out of cars in particular. And we've seen, particularly in the March, April, May time frame, where there were a lot of stay-at-home type orders across the U.S. from a variety of states, as well as countries, because there was less car travel going on and other kinds of travel, airline as well. The air did get cleaner in the sense that those pollutant gases, those nitrous oxides, were being measured to be in fewer concentrations.
Okay, so it did change. John, well, you were going to add?
Yeah, Steve's right on about that. It changed visibility and air quality, but those are not really weather elements per se. So it
that's
you know, a local, in terms of time, a short-term fluctuation in carbon dioxide output will nearly not change the weather, because the weather is occurring, you know, in the foreground of a really gigantic, slow-moving background climate change that won't really notice 6 months of reduced carbon dioxide input in a way that you can tell right away by weather. So, yeah, I think that's exactly right, that we've had some positive impacts from this in terms of air quality and visibility, but there's probably been no discernible change in the weather.
Okay. All right. Jim, thank you for calling. Mark in Bloomer, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hey, friend. My hospice colleagues and I are driving around every day, all day, helping people die. And one of the gifts we have up here in the Chippewa Valley is watching the leaves change. And reminds us of the life and death cycle, the trees, the life and death cycle of us. They were so vibrant and beautiful this year, better than ever I've seen in a long, long time. That's all I have to say.
Oh, Mark, thank you so much for calling. Well, they were beautiful.
Thanks for sharing that. That's an interesting way to be looking at life in general.
Yeah, and for somebody in Mark's kind of position, you got to be looking for that sort of thing a lot. Mark, thank you again, and thanks for your work too. Appreciate that as well. Raleigh in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Raleigh. Raleigh, are you there? Oh, I guess we lost. He had a question about the role of water vapor in climate change. Not sure what that was about, but we lost him. You know, last time you were on, we talked about the packed hurricane season we've been experiencing. It technically ends in November, and we've already run out of alphabet letters to use. Is that right?
Yeah. We've got Tropical Storm Zeta right now, and that's the sixth letter, I think, in the Greek alphabet. So we've gone to the 32nd named storm of the year. And I don't remember if we've ever gotten to Zeta. Maybe we've done it once. 2005 was an active season, but I don't know if we've ever gotten to named storm Zeta. So this has been the most prolific, or one of the most prolific, Atlantic hurricane seasons of all time. So, and it's still not over. There's going to be an impact of this event, it looks like, 3 or 4 days from now on the coast of Louisiana again. So a brutal year for Louisiana.
Why is it? What's the value of naming those hurricanes? Is there a particular value to it?
You know, I think probably helps you to catalog the season from year to year, because there aren't as many tropical storms per year as there are extra tropical storms. I mean, there's a commercial interest in naming winter storms, and it's not media, it's not from the National Weather Service. It's from the weather company. So it's purely commercial. And it's kind of a fool's errand in the sense that there's just so many extra tropical storms in a given cold season. But for the tropical cyclones, they're relatively rare. Here we are talking about 33 of them in a five-month period, and that's probably the largest number of all time. So in the Atlantic Basin. So they just aren't that frequent. And so it makes it easier to discuss them comparatively as scientific entities, probably, and public impact entities as well as the years go by to name them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Steve Ackerman and John Martin back with us, professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and of course, always our weather guys, and they come by the last Monday of every month. And they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today to take your questions. You can call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Steve and John. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, back with us, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve is also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. So what weather climate questions are coming to your mind? Have you noticed something interesting about the weather? Did you get some early snow? Join in. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. A caller who couldn't stay online had a few questions related to hurricanes. She said the NPR news report said that we're on the 27th storm, but just heard you guys say a different number and wondering why is that? She also said it seemed like they started using Greek letters right after T. Is that true and why?
I can't tell you that I know that's untrue. I know that in the past they've gone past the letter T, but I don't know. So that's a good question. I guess it would be easy to check by going to the National Hurricane Center website and just seeing the list of this year's storms. So that's possible, but I'm not sure of that.
Yeah,
they do go past T. They go to V and W. But
that's right, Wilma, 2005.
Yeah, right. That's right, yeah. They don't use all of the letters. And so I think when John did his quick calculation, I think he used all 26 letters of the alphabet.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
But
yeah,
I did. Use Z or Y. So that's why I think it's right. I think it is 27th storm.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And heading towards a record. I don't remember how many 2005 had, but it's within one storm, either behind tie or above this year. Then.
Yeah. Well, if they cut out the same letters from the Roman alphabet in 2005 as they did this year, I know we had an epsilon in 2005, but I don't think we had a zeta. So this might be in excess of 2005's remarkable year. So regardless of my miscalculation of the total number, I think it might be a record. Yeah.
Well, let's take some more calls. You can join in, too, again at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Jolie in Mosinee, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jolie.
Good morning, or good afternoon it is now. I would like to question about, what about the fires out west? How are they affecting the weather around here?
Well, we had in the first round of those fires that were record-breaking in September, I think we had several days where, before the trees were starting to turn, the sky was orange. So we had a lot of color in the off the ground this fall. Part of it was the sky and during the fire, the first round of the really big fires, and now we've got our beautiful foliage turning. So now I don't think there's quite as big an impact on visibility as far east as Wisconsin. But that's because the fires they're not quite as extensive as they were, except if you're in a spot where they're happening, there's still horrible bad news, but they're not quite as extensive.
And, of course, the weather's had a huge impact on the fires themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
So the weather the weather certainly leads up to getting the fires in terms of having a drought, and then also helping to put them out through snowfall and precipitation.
Yeah, yeah, and the winds for the strong winds for just carrying those flames a lot faster. Yeah. Before we settled into the cooler weather we're experiencing right now, we had a lot of ups and downs with the fall weather, and I think coming up, looks like there's going to be a mostly warming trend in at least in southern Wisconsin. But there's been a lot of up and down, including some nice 70 degree days after a week of cool weather. What contributes to all these temperature changes during the fall?
We get a couple of big factors that play a role in this part of the country. One of them is purely geography. When the flow across the continent of North America is mostly from west to east, and we've had several episodes of that kind of broadly, we call it zonal, because zonal means straight west to east in our science, broadly zonal flow, then we get a lot of subsidence over the high terrain to the west, and that produces the Rocky Mountains, and that produces bubbles of warm air in the lower part of the troposphere out over the high plains. And those bubbles of warm air gradually work their way eastward and give us some of those really nice warm days that we can get in the fall. Another mechanism is if the flow, again, in the upper troposphere is quite high, very wavy, and they can have excursions of the air from low latitudes that kind of blow up towards us. That's when we get warm and muggy in the fall, and we had a couple episodes of those. So those are the two main types of broad-scale situations that can give us, you know, several days in a row of unusually warm weather. Though I will say, I know I'm hogging the air here a little bit, I will say we did, in fact, tie our all-time record this year of the earliest last 80-degree Fahrenheit temperature in Madison. And that was September 2nd, and we tied the record that was also set September 2nd, 1977. So we haven't been 80 degrees since September 2nd, and that's unusually long for this time of year.
Interesting. Jeannie in Milwaukee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. Well, that was a great explanation of our local weather pattern. I've been a longtime follower of weather, so I find this very fun. I noticed this year that the clouds look different. And I even heard a local weather reporter observed that he had noted the clouds in his career had never seen them look like this. And to me, what it appears is that it's more evident at sunset, and it's like the backlighting of when you see a backlit cloud. It's like there's this kind of dark gray, blackish undercoating behind the cloud. Like, to me, they're looking really dirty. Is this on your radar? Have you at all seen differences in here or in recent times?
Go ahead.
I was going to say that I think this past summer, part of that was due to the smokes from the fires out west. And so in the satellite imagery, you could clearly see that the smoke was coming over us. And that did a couple of things. One is it really made our sunsets really orangey, like John had mentioned earlier. But other times, you know, it would be just a smooth layer during the daytime. And it would give the appearance of what a thin layer of cirrus cloud would look like. But it was much more grayer than that. And, and not as white or bright and more uniform, if you will, than what we'd normally see with cirrus clouds, which are the high ice clouds that we often see during this time of year.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. And I noticed, I forget exactly when it was, I think it was mid to late September, we had maybe even early, late August, we had a much higher than normal number of days where the rainfall from a little shower had ended at precisely the right time to have the sort of contrails, or precipitation streams being backlit by the sun. So we had a lot of orange skies that were not related to, at sunset, that were not related to the fire. So it was a really wild year. I mean, if those are the elements that kind of conspire to have somebody get the opinion that it was a weird year for clouds, I think I would agree. But otherwise, it's a little bit off my radar.
Oh. Jeannie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Claire in Fox Point, it's your turn. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I have a question about volcanoes and debris from them. In 1980, I was part of a group that bicycled across the United States. We started on the West Coast and ended on the East Coast. And that was the year that Mount St. Helens erupted. And we had a lot of rain during the trip. And I thought I had read that the debris from the volcano, like, seeded the clouds. And I was wondering if that is true and if the wildfires do the same thing.
Okay. I'm glad you went west to east because you had the wind at your back most of the time.
Yeah, but I'll bet it always seemed like it was in her face.
Yes.
Anyway. Right, that's exactly right.
Yeah, you know, anytime you put more aerosols in the atmosphere, whether it's from fires or from volcanic eruptions like Mount St. Helens, you can impact the concentration of the types of droplets that are in clouds. And typically you make them smaller, which also has a tendency to make the clouds brighter and also reduce the tendency for them to precipitate because the particles are smaller. I think in the case of Mount St. Helens, you know, that was an explosive event that, you know, within a couple of days, essentially it was over because most of that volcanic ash stayed in the troposphere and therefore washed out, unlike some other more explosive volcanoes where the aerosols go into the stratosphere and then they can have a longer impact. And then with the fires, I think it's a similar thing, except the fires lasted for a long time through most of the summer. So what the impact is on precipitation, I don't know. I would imagine somebody's going to be looking at that statistically.
Yeah, I would think so, too. Yeah, I would think so, too.
Claire, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Richard in Blair, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Richard.
Yes, I just, first of all, I'm a retired mining engineer and geologist, and I wanted to bring point of an issue on the global warming is that we are in an interglacial area for the last 10,000 years. The sea level has been rising. The temperature has gone up a good 15 degrees, 18 degrees. And the carbon dioxide has increased significantly, about 100 parts per million over that period of time. Now, it's not to deny global warming. It's just to say that this has been going on. And in the last 100 years, we have been burning coal and oil that have been sequestered for tens of millions of years during the age of the dinosaurs and Cretaceous period. So, yes, we are significantly contributing to the global warming, something that has been going on, as I say, for 10,000 years.
Yeah. Richard, thanks for calling. Comment, John, do you want to take it?
Yeah, Richard's right. We're in a period where over 10,000 or so years, the planet has warmed a little bit and the carbon dioxide fraction has rebounded from a low of usually these lows that occur on sort of 50 to 100,000 year timescales get down as low about 180 parts per million. That is molecules per million molecules, and then have never risen in the last million or so years above 300 molecules per million. In the last half century or 70 or so years, we've gone, because this is the record that goes back to Mauna Loa in 1958, the carbon dioxide fraction has increased from barely over 300 molecules per million to something now over 410 molecules per million. So we've never seen the numbers, the concentration of carbon dioxide that we have right now. So there's no doubt that you could have a human-induced change that is piggybacking on top of what's a natural change, and that may well be the case, but it provides no argument, and I know our caller did not suggest it, but it provides no argument at all to indicate that the human-caused part of it is not significant, because it really is. We're in uncharted territory right now in terms of carbon dioxide concentration in the Earth's atmosphere, and as a consequence, we know exactly what's going to happen and is currently happening, and that is that the planet warms up. What the manifestations of that are for local weather and sustainability of agricultural infrastructure and all that, we don't know exactly as well. But we sure know that that's the case.
Yeah. Richard, thank you very much for calling. Bill in St. Germain, on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
About a week ago, Friday, we had a big snowstorm.
Yep.
And in the middle of the snowstorm, the sky turned yellow for about an hour.
Wow.
What time of day was that?
Midday.
Midday. Wow.
Yeah.
Why would that be the case, Steve?
I don't know. I'm trying to imagine. Midday, the sun is still high up in the sky. And again, the ash wasn't coming over us at that time. Mm. So I'm not sure what would cause it.
No refraction in ice or weird pieces of ice or anything, Steve, could do that? Not at midday, right?
Yeah, and at midday you would get other colors, I think, besides the yellow, right? You would also get some reds and oranges associated with it as well.
Yeah, that's weird. Man, that's something.
Yeah, you don't happen to have a picture, do you, Bill?
No. Yeah. The local weather guy said it was a thinning in the upper atmosphere.
What does that mean?
And that was the same color effect you get when the sun is setting, only we got it in the middle of the day.
Hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't go with thinning, because usually you get the colors at sunset when the sun is low and passing through more atmosphere, not less atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that one is, Bill, thanks for calling, but that's one our weather guys are probably going to be pondering a while and maybe asking some others what they think, too.
Yeah, we should send them an umbrella for stumping the weather guys.
Yeah, right. Well, not only stumping us, thousands of people have done that, but we didn't even want to suggest an answer. That's what's unusual.
You can usually come up with something.
Right, that's what's unusual.
True or not.
And so with that, we'll move right along to Joan in Watertown. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I saw something very strange as well. This was in Watertown, sort of at the southeast edge of town. It was about maybe 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And the entire sky above me, I was in my car, the entire sky looked like the foam that will stick to your glass if you're drinking a glass of really foamy beer or a foamy latte or something. How that foam will stick to the glass, and the whole sky looked like that. And then here and there, there were maybe 3 or 4 areas where it looked like something, like a paw with like 4 claws in it, made like a claw mark here. And then later on, you know, a paw of claws over there, and, you know, separate from each other, quite separate from each other.
So patches of lines.
Yes, little patches of lines like that.
Could you tell if it was high in the atmosphere or low?
No, it seemed low.
It seemed low.
That could be, I wonder if it, I don't know if this is true, but maybe you can have these really fairly shallow, not too deep, stratocumulus clouds that have a really tight cellular structure. So that would give you the foamy look. And then maybe there's been some aircraft penetration through the clouds or something like that that gives you these striations. And they're very local. They're in one spot. And you might not notice the plane going through because, you know, it takes a while for those clouds to get seeded by the exhaust from the planes. But that's one thing that comes to mind to me. But maybe I have the ingredients wrong in my head as I'm trying to figure it out.
Yeah, Steve, that's one that came to my head as well, John, you know, the distrails. as jet aircraft go through those low-level stratus clouds. The other one, and I'm thinking sort of the same lines, like a cellular structure, like a Bernard cell type thing in the clouds. We see them over oceans a lot, these actinia they're called, where you get these star-like patterns, and it looks like, in a satellite image anyway, and probably from down below too, the foamy structure that you would get on the side of a glass.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Those are beautiful.
Yeah, but I don't know if I've never seen them on land, but it doesn't mean they couldn't be happening over the lake and moving inward if you're in water when you're getting close to Lake Michigan, I think.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
maybe
that's a good one.
Yeah, maybe Jill Nadeau, she lives in Watertown. She was probably doing some experimenting in her backyard and created a problem. Who knows? Joan, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Jeff and Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Well, thanks for taking the call. Your expert has claimed that the Earth has been, you know, goes through this cycle, warming, colding, whatever. It's done that forever. Given the fact that the United States has the cleanest air we've ever had, what percent of climate change is caused by people versus just the normal cycle of the world?
Okay. John?
I'll make an estimate. I'll say that since, and I'm just basing it on these numbers, since in the last couple of million years, we can't go very far, much farther back than that with the same kind of confidence. We've seen the carbon dioxide fraction, as we can best represent it by proxy measurements, bounce between 180 and about 300 molecules per million. Currently, we're at 410. So we've increased it by one-third of its prior long-term peak. So that seems to me that that would mean we have about a third of the blame at a minimum on what's going on currently, because we've pushed it that far above the prior 2 million year average maximum value. So I'd say, yeah, we got about a third at least of the responsibility for what's happening to the climate right now. And that's industrialization.
Industrialization. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for that question. And, oh, my goodness, here we are out of time already. Boy, this has gone by fast. John and Steve, thank you. Well, maybe not for Steve. You've been here for the whole 90 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. It seems like forever.
But I want to thank you guys both very much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to your next visit, the November 30th. The last Monday in November. Right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah. Thank you.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve, of course, also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education. Back on November 30th. Tomorrow, we'll answer all your pet care questions with veterinarian Dr. Bill Stork. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.